Hello everyone and welcome to Hashtag Team Early Childhood Podcast. This week we have the fantastic Dr. Valerie Daniel, who is going to be speaking to us about diversity in the early years. Hi Val.
Hey Aaron, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
Good, a bit tired, but I'm all right.
Oh, good, good. Yeah. So how are you feeling about doing your first podcast, Val?
Apprehensive, scared, but really excited, really, really excited.
Great. So, Val, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Right. My name is Dr. Valerie Daniel. I'm a head teacher of a nursery school. I did my thesis on perceptions of a crisis in the early years sector, and I have a very keen interest in how crises of any nature, how they develop. So it's really been a very interesting couple of weeks for me in terms of linking elements of my research to the current context that we're currently living in. So very interesting space.
Fantastic. Yeah. And people, just to let everyone know that me and Valerie know each other quite well. So
yeah.
I do apologise because I'm calling you Val. But I know you as Val, don't I? So just putting that context out there so that people know. So basically, Val, we've got six questions that we planned ahead.
Yeah.
And they're all questions. Obviously, some of them are about you, about your positionality, but a couple of them are about the context of diversity in the early years. And I think I'm sure you will probably agree that having that discussion now is probably so pertinent and on point that really we probably need to highlight the fantastic stuff that actually is going on in the early years, but areas that we probably need to move forwards with as well.
Yeah.
So question number six is always the same. Everyone gets the same question, which is about your three wishes. So you've given us a brief overview of yourself, but if you could explain a little bit more about yourself and what you've done with your research, basically what was the outcome of your research, just quite quickly, and so tell us a bit about you and your research.
Okay, so my interest in this area of research was based in the fact that I was operating in a context in the early years that did not seem to make a lot of sense. We were working, the early years is devised of mainly two main aspects, and that is the maintained sector and the PVI sector, which is a private, voluntary and independent sector. And the very strange concept that sits behind all of that is that they operate on divergent concepts. So the maintained sector absolutely looks at universal and inclusive ways of early years, of delivering early years. And the PVI sector looks at how we manage that in a more with a business concept that sits behind it.
Yeah.
So that there is, you are immediately battling in between universalism and this context of individualism, everybody making their own penny off their own pot. So they're two divergent concepts that the earlier sector actually sits on top of. And it's designed in a way that the sector ends up fighting against itself, which is at the moment in the current context, the current context is actually quite combustible.
Yeah.
So it's not a healthy place. And adding the dynamics of a pandemic to this situation is absolutely explosive. It doesn't sit well for anybody because you're looking at a sector that's divided in ways that we probably don't comprehend as quickly as we should, because as a sector we should be operating more cohesively. But looking at it now in the current context, when it's shed, when it is shown under the light of COVID-19 and all the stuff that's happening in the world at the moment, it is quite a sad place to be, really.
One thing that I think I've picked up on, I've been shouting out about your research now for quite a while, and you came and did a live session, didn't you, at the university? Do you remember that? And yes. that was immense. And what I love about your research, Val, is how applicable it actually is, and how, you know, it is a good piece. I mean, it's a very sound piece of research, but actually there's a lot we can pick out from that in our current context. And I know that you're going to discuss that, you know, in a bit, really. But it can actually, your research can be applied, I mean, to any context that we're seeing at the moment. Would you like to explain how that is playing out currently with, obviously, what we're seeing with COVID-19?
You mean in the sense of diversity?
Yeah.
Or diversity. Yeah. So one of the big issues that we have, in not an issue actually, it's a strength of the early years, is that we tend to speak about children as being unique. We tend to speak about the rights of the child. We're very child-centered in early years. But what we seem to be doing in some ways is preparing children for a world that they will never live in. And that I find to be a very, very scary concept. So if we are saying that when children sit within our care and we're ticking these boxes of all the rights that a child is entitled to as an individual, but when it comes to this child being a child of color or a child with a disability or a child that may grow up to be LGBTQ or a child that may have challenges around the, you know, just the way they process information, whatever, the world suddenly becomes a very, very unequal place.
Yeah.
So clearly we have got some serious issues within the education system that need to be addressed from the early years, from the very, very beginning. And it starts with us as educators, no matter who you are. Yeah. Are you self-aware? Are you aware of what you are putting out there? And one of the things that strikes me is if you literally, as a white educator, if you are in some ways not understanding your privilege, then you could inadvertently be embedding issues of systemic racism without even meaning to. But it is very, very much an issue that we have, and educators have to understand their role in lifelong learning, how they impact on children, how they impact on anybody, people's lives when they're growing up. It's huge. And if you understand that somehow you haven't challenged yourself to think about your standpoint and to actually inform yourself about the bits that impact a nation, a society in the wider sense, and you're in effect creating a more unequal society while you are preaching about rights, that's an oxymoronic state at best. And at worst, we are actually just not really practicing what we preach.
Yeah. So, and that kind of links, and that kind of is the same type of message with what your research is about, really, about the positionality of you know, that conflict, isn't it? That that conflict approach in the earlier sector. And I just think the model that you've written about really applies to a lot of what we do and how we do it and how we approach it in the early years, which is really, really important. Okay, so for this podcast, Val, you've decided to look at diversity in the early years. Can you explain why diversity is important for the early years and basically how we need to take it on board moving forwards?
I think diversity is embedded into a multicultural society. It is very much an element of life. It is what it is. If we cannot look at another human being and actually just accept them as a member of the human race, we've got problems. But you know where it becomes a bigger problem? The bigger problem is when you sit in this state of passivity where you're not even aware that you're doing that. It is such an embedded culture. You're not aware that you're actually treating another human being as if they're less than, or that you are more superior than they are. So a lot of what we do is around expectations. And I don't know how many times within the education system, even in early years, you hear things like, well, what do you expect from that family? You can't expect much from them. They don't have this or they don't have that, which is a very, very deficit model. It's a model that blames the victim. And that is a huge aspect of systemic racism. So if we are finding ourselves in this role of where we're constantly in some ways saying, well, if they knew better, and you're judging people against your own standards without understanding theirs, you are actually creating a space for selectivity, a space where you can, there, you know, this prejudice thrives. So, you know, I find when I was in the children's center, a lot of when I used to run a children's center, a lot of my staff who were white came away with this. It was almost like they were missionaries. I had to kind of say to them,
saviors.
I have to be like, I'm really sorry, but you're here to do a job. This is not about how good it makes you feel. Because I was actually accused of, before you came here, I used to feel good about how I helped these people on a daily basis. And now that you're here, you've taken away that feeling from me. And I was just absolutely blown away by that. The way that came across as I am more superior and I'm here to save these people, and no, you don't even want me to feel good about that. If you looked at these people, as you call them, as your equals, but they're in a particularly sad set of circumstances at this point in their life, you wouldn't have that standpoint.
Yeah.
And what we end up doing is having a hero worship context that all it does is maintain the status quo. I would look at these parents who would worship these individuals because of these handouts that they gave them. And we started creating a whole other dynamic where people stopped trying to be a part of their own solution and started depending on their saviors to sort them out. That is a very sad consequence of operating in this way. But more than all, Aaron, just one last thing. Inequality makes no sense on in terms of economics. It makes no sense for a country to operate with inequality, because what we're doing is draining massive amounts of the country's coffers, just pouring it down the drain, because you've created a scenario where people who could be contributing properly to the country's to prosperity in the country are being marginalized, dehumanized. They're being, you know, locked up in jail. They're not given the same opportunities as other people. They become a drain on the system. And more than all, they begin to believe what they're being told on a daily basis. You are no good. You are, you know, you're good for nothing. So we do have a problem that starts right in the early years.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And so this leads us on to the next question, really. So can you give us some ways that you fight that kind of anti-oppressive practice in your school, and how to promote that diversity?
Right. I accept, first of all, that any talk about diversity and making a difference in diversity is going to be infinitely more easier for me because I'm a Black woman. So I understand that there are challenges for somebody who is white bringing that up. And the reason I say there is a challenge is if you're not secure in how you feel and you're attempting to tick a box, this will blow up in your face. You have to be secure enough to know you are doing the right thing for the right reasons. You're not attempting to tick a box to appease a system. So the very first thing that I did in my school was create safe spaces for conversation where nobody was going to be penalized for anything they said.
Right.
Nobody was going to be taken to task, and whatever hard feelings came up in that room had to be resolved in that room before we left it, we left the room, because we didn't want any residual feelings spilling over into our work day. So that was one of the things we did. Another really hard exercise that we do in our school is the exercise of listening. I mean, actively listening. So, and this is a really challenging one. So we have people in pairs who somebody will stand up and speak their truth no matter what it is.
Yeah.
And the person they're speaking their truth to must not answer to what is being said. They must not defend it. They need to process it and reframe it back and say it back only what they've heard, not answer to the issue. So basically, let me do that to you now, Aaron. I am going to say to you, and this is role play, I'm going to say to you, Aaron, you really, really upset me because what you did the other day by telling me that I am just angry and I'm useless and what you want me to do is to do things this way and I don't particularly want to do it that way. So what I need for you to do now is tell me that back without being defensive. Do you get that? So somebody's in your face speaking their truth, their anger, and you, as the person who is being accused, I'm asking you not to defend yourself, but to really listen and turn around and say, what I'm hearing is
that
you're very angry because what I said to you on such a day offended you in this way. I inadvertently accused you of being an angry person who was behaving in such a way. Am I understanding what you're saying? And I promise you, Aaron, it was one of the hardest things that every time we do it in my school, what you want is people that are just chomping at the bit to be defensive, even when it's a scenario they're still trying to be defensive.
Yeah.
Instead of just reframing what they're hearing and asking, am I clear? Am I really, truly understanding you? Am I hearing you? So it's a powerful exercise.
And that's really, really good for children as well, isn't it? Because actually, you know, it's hearing what children, and more so parents and carers as well, the families that are coming in, you know.
It's a practice. It's something that I have to ask my staff to practice. Are you truly hearing? Are we jumping to conclusions because of our own biases?
Yes.
And are we doing justice to the people that come through these doors? Although they won't be coming through the doors now with COVID, so that's another skill.
No. So how do you? Obviously, you've talked very much from a, you know. Would you agree that you've got to start from the setting, the staff, the changing the perception there before we can change, you know, moving forwards? Do you believe that you need to start in your setting?
Oh, absolutely, Anne, because if we don't accept that the change, you see, we look at what we do in our classrooms as a tiny drop in the ocean.
Yeah.
But actually, that tiny drop is the force behind changing. It can cause a societal tidal wave. It's about how we consistently make that drop. And one of the things that we have to do is look at ourselves, is look at each other. You know, when you first sit in a staff room, and the conversations we have in my school, I think, would frighten people, because they are really, really genuine ones. And it is about, it's close to the bone, but nobody goes away offended. And if they do, they will come back and say, actually, I wasn't happy about that. And it's because we have created that safe space to say whatever it is that you need to say, so it can be challenged, or we can go, what is it that's put you in this mindset? How did we get to this place? Because a lot of people, discrimination is a funny thing, you know, Aaron. It's not black and white.
No.
There is colorism. There are black people who don't want black people to lead them.
Yeah.
There are, you know, I have had a situation where the cleaner in my school went ballistic on me, telling me I'm a white man. And he said, what he basically said to me was, even though I earned a lot more money, which he was clearly upset about, he will always be better than me.
Yeah.
So there is something radically wrong with that mindset, because I really challenge myself not to treat anybody as if they don't matter. So anybody who comes through my doors, I say to them, we all work for this city council, and all of us have a role to perform. This is mine, that is yours. But without all of them, it doesn't work. So this is a person I've treated with that respect who absolutely blew up, because he basically told me, I don't like taking instructions from a woman. I mean, he didn't say black woman, but he may well have. And I don't like you telling me what to do. Well, after he had that complete meltdown, within a month, he was gone.
Yeah.
So there is something, you know, behind all of what's being said, but we have to create the spaces for people to air it. Because if you always feel that you have to mute your voice, and I'm speaking about white people, if you feel that your voice has to be muted to tick a box, just to say you are conforming to equalities and whatever the legislation that sits, in you know, that you have to tick a box about. You may mute the voice, but that scream that's in you is still inside.
Yeah.
And it's going to come out at some point. So when you encase people's thoughts under concrete and force them to layer all sorts on top, it does not take away what that core feeling is if it never comes out and we don't ever talk about it.
And it is sometimes about creating those safe spaces so that we can change those mindsets, isn't it? We can't change people. We can't give people that information if we don't create the opportunities for people to be able to speak about them.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's what you've produced at your school. You've produced a safe space where there may not be a silly question, or there may be a very challenging discussion, but actually that person is learning too.
Yeah.
And that's the most important. That kind of leads us on to the next question, which is there any key research or reading, and if you're, you know, this, let's be mindful that the whole of the earlier sector you've already highlighted is very, very different. Where shall we start? Like, where would we start to learn about,
I've been thinking about this, Aaron, since you sent this to me, and I like to keep things simple. And one of the things I'm going to ask anybody who asks me this question is, I would say start as a book club. And I would start with the book How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi. And what's nice about the book club context is that there are discussion questions that sit with that. And those discussion questions are really, really good because it hits the context that, for example, the opposite of racist is not, I am not racist. That's not the opposite. Opposite of racist is anti-racist, because by saying I'm not racist doesn't mean that you're anti-racist. You could just be okay with people, but you really want to maintain the status quo. Yeah. So there is a whole lot of things, but it's the fact that racism is fluid. You can be a racist today and be anti-racist tomorrow, because we're human beings, and it's how we challenge ourselves on a daily basis to look at what we're saying and how do we check ourselves, how do we hold ourselves accountable. Yeah. Yeah. Those are the things that matter, because we have to reach people on a human level about these issues. We can't make it them, you know, we can't attach shame to it. We can't attach, I'm ready to just fight with you because you've offended me to it. Because all that does is that it just keeps us spinning in the same spot.
And it's important that we don't approach it with that with aggression, because what happens when you've got aggression is people shut down. And if people shut down, what's not happening? Well, we're not having a discussion about it. We're not actually engaging. And I think it's really pertinent to say that your approach is the opposite to that, really.
Absolutely.
You challenge, but you do it in a positive way.
And absolutely.
You've got somewhere with that, really, haven't you? You know, we've started to see that people are engaging with you, people are talking with you. And I think, you know, I've said this to you before, Val, that, you know, when you felt oppression, you understand, well, I don't understand, but I can empathise.
Absolutely.
And empathy is probably one of the strongest things that we can have as a human being.
And all we need, isn't it? If you come from the standpoint of do unto others as you would have them do to you, you immediately start thinking, okay, let me have a look at this in a different way.
Yeah.
So It is an interesting space to be in, because the thing about tackling issues of systemic racism that is evident in all the systems we have, it's evident in church, it's evident in school, yeah. It's evident yeah. in business. I could tell you stories of things that happened to me. So when I'm in school, I am, you know, everybody knows I'm the head teacher. I'm treated with respect. I'm dressed professionally. I speak articulately. I'm fine. But I go into Marks and Spencer's and the security man is following me around the shop.
Yeah.
You know, for what reason? And he probably don't, but they've profiled me as something yeah. that I absolutely am not.
Well, look at and what me and happens. You know, I mean, we haven't shared this with anybody yet, have
yeah.
we? But
yeah.
You know, let's talk about what happened up in Leeds when we went to Brewhead.
Yeah.
You know, we both were in the same hotel, not the same room, guys. Just thought we'd put that out there.
We've got the previous Aaron, be careful.
But what happened? I mean, are you happy to tell the story, Val? I mean, I mean, because yeah, I, rightly so, I was ready to.
You know. Keeping the story with me. So
yeah.
We were there waiting in the waiting to be seen. And this woman that was
Well, you got there first, didn't you? You
I
got
was there
first. You were waiting for me. Yeah.
I was waiting for you, that's right. And the woman that was behind the desk, she was Eastern European. She was she had tattoos all in her face and down her body. And I had a gut reaction to that. When I walked in, and yeah. then I remember physically checking myself and saying, what does that mean to you, Val? You're reacting to this woman without knowing her. So I before I even approached the desk, I had processed that in my mind, went up, was respectful. She treated me like I was nothing.
She did.
I cannot explain how bad it was. She wouldn't give me anything that... She wouldn't sort out the issue that I had around changing my room. She wouldn't do anything. In fact, this young black girl had to take it all over and treat me with respect. And I remember sitting there, Aaron came and he said, what's going on? And I said, you'd not believe what I went through. Well, Mr. Aaron was ready to go over and just sort her out and say, leave it alone. Leave it alone.
I was fuming. I was absolutely fuming.
I know. I was too angry as well to deal with it. But what I didn't tell you, Aaron, was I dealt with it the next morning.
Yeah,
I came back downstairs when I was dressed and looking like Mrs. Valerie Daniel now to do my talk at Brewhead. And I said to her, can I just say something to you? Service is not about who you, it's not about other people, it's about you. It's about your ability to deliver the same standard of service to every single person that walks through this door. Because selective service is just poor service. It is not a standard of service. It That's means right. that what you are delivering here in this hotel is poor. So I was asked if I wanted to make a complaint. I said, no, I'm not here to take your food out of your mouth. I am here to tell you, do not treat people like this anymore, right. because you don't know who
it was.
It
was really bad, because if you remember, me and you were sitting having some lunch.
Yeah.
And that young black girl came over and apologized for her for that
over.
Girl's behavior. Do you over. Remember?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
she came and apologized for, you know, for you know, the other lady's behavior.
Yeah.
And I was, I mean, as you know, I wasn't best pleased.
I know.
You know, but
yeah.
it was awful, wasn't it? Because you watched, because you fed back about how I was treated when I walked yeah. through the door,
yeah.
Compared to you, and it yes. was really, 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 and it did affect us, didn't it, Val? I mean,
it did, but it affected us in the way that we know that we will always stand up for when something isn't
yeah.
right, and
yeah.
that was enough for me, because I knew you would have stood up for me and gone, this is not right, you
yeah.
don't get. My friend like
yeah that. But you told and me that, to stop you told me
yeah,
not to
I
do
tell
it,
you to stop it because you were too angry.
I was angry but too
I know you were, because it was too much. But What I was saying about that is that when you're trying to deal with things like that, the first thing you have to have is information.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to respond to all kinds of challenges, because when people are being forced into this place of this space of change, it's a painful, it's not an easy place to be. So one of the things that I generally have to fight against is statistics. So you get statistics thrown at you like, well, 58% of crimes that happen in the UK are done by so-and-so and so. And then when you sort of go, well, you do realise that the black population is only 3% of the UK population, right? So what you're saying statistically does not amount to what you think it does.
Yeah.
And it's those kinds of challenges about, you know, all the different elements of why somebody would go, why are you saying Black Lives Matter as if all lives don't matter?
Yeah.
It's, you know, this cry of all lives matter. All lives do matter. But right now we're talking about the fact that Black people are going through something quite difficult. Yeah. Black people are crying out for equality. So are you then saying that, are you attempting to dilute my point or my struggle? Because that's what you're doing. You're diluting my struggle. And what you're doing is infilling it with a platitude.
Yeah.
You're just saying, well, let's not do that. And let's say, oh, by the way, but you don't have the same struggle as me. And trying to explain to somebody that privilege is not about how much money you've earned. I had a guy on Twitter, and for 4 days we spoke, and he goes, you're a head teacher. You earn much more money than I've ever earned. And this is my country. I'm a white man in this country. And I'm saying, but that's not what it is. Privilege does not mean that you don't struggle. It just means that you don't have to add the element of color to that struggle.
That's right.
Yeah, so you put on a suit, and I said to him, you put on a suit and walk into any establishment, you will not get the challenges that I have. And here I am dressed professionally, and I still get followed around. So you have to start thinking about those issues.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So these are your last couple of questions. So what are we likely to see from you, Val, in the near future?
Well,
anything big, anything planned? Well,
there is all sorts going on, Aaron. I have just written a blog called The Anger Within the Process of Change, The Role of Anger Within the Process of Change, which I found very interesting. And it was actually really therapeutic because it calmed me down and helped me to approach this systematically rather than running with my anger, you know, running with that, and to reduce your anger from this impotent rage to where it's righteous indignation and to where you are in an assertive state of anger where you've created a space for change, not this place that you're running around, running amok, doing all, you know, things that are not really helpful. So that's one thing I've done. I have written an article with Dr. Pam Jarvis.
Lovely.
Around where Brexit and systemic racism sits in the current context that we're in, why we're in a crisis state, why is it when we have something as damaging as COVID-19 that people are choosing to come out en masse and protest despite knowing they could die.
Yeah.
And this is when you know you've hit a place in life where people are saying, give me liberty or give me death. You know, that's a hard message to swallow. So there is a lot of that. We've explored that as well. I have, I'm doing this podcast with you, which is really exciting. I'm on a couple of groups that are going to be launched in the very near future, where we really are looking at education. And
so there's going to be a BAME, Ed EY, isn't there? So BAME Ed Early Years,
And another group that we're looking at education. Education against racism.
Yeah.
So looking at, you know, equity and looking at what we need in education to unpick some of these elements of racism. One of the things I find myself saying quite a bit is that systemic racism is a tapestry.
Yeah.
And if we can't unpick it with a pitchfork, you need to have the right tools to do the right thing. This is not about shaming people. It's not about putting people in, you know, or the worst thing I think people fear is that Black people are looking for power. It's not about power. It literally is about equality.
That's right.
So it's those are the things that are popping up. I've been asked to address a heads group in Buckinghamshire.
Yeah.
And I am going to speak about the child as a bearer of human rights. So similarly to what we're saying here.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know, how do we get to that state where we truly understand about human rights as it applies to all of us and to children. So,
and are we likely to see a book from you eventually? Are we?
Will you pick me, Aaron? I don't get to have a choice. You keep pushing. But what's been really exciting this week is Charles T. Dale, who is an actor, in Casualty.
Yeah,
I did speak to him about. He writes poems. He calls himself the Lockdown Laureate. And since COVID, he's been doing a lot of poetry, which is brilliant. And he just kind of casually said one day, well, I do have an opinion about Black Lives Matter, but maybe nobody wants to hear it. And I said to him, I want to hear it because your voice is as valid as mine. The Black Lives Matter movement is not a Black issue. It's an everybody issue.
It's an everybody issue, yeah.
And
it's quite powerful, isn't it, Val? Yeah. It's very powerful. It's actually motivating other areas of oppression. So actually, it's given other people a voice.
And that's exactly where we're looking. That's what equality is.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just about colour. But
sorry, I butted in there and you were finishing off about...
No, I'm just saying that he did. He did it and... It's doing incredibly well on Twitter.
Yeah.
And I've done one of my poems. I rebooted one of my poems that I wrote back in 2005 called The Underlying Fact. But I rebooted it inspired by him. So it's been an interesting week all over, really. Yeah.
So my last question is.
Yeah.
Question number 6. If I could grant you 3 wishes, what would they be?
Okay, Aaron, you see, I'm a very greedy person, so I'm going to give you 3 professional wishes, and then I'm going to grant you what my 3 personal wishes that you can grant me with. So my 3 professional wishes is that we truly get to a place of equality. It's a journey, but if you could give me that, the step on the journey where people are committed to this change, that would be the most amazing thing.
Mm-hmm.
If we could look, the second one is the plight of people, that we don't always see people as their circumstances are their fault all the time. So we, you know, if we could start unpicking the deficit model that we have built education around, and you know, where the space that government occupies around how they deal with issues of societal suffering and things like that. That would be great. The third thing you could grant me is everybody having just some time to have that peace of mind where they are at complete peace with themselves. When you get to that place, no matter what the turbulence is, and you can have joy in your life, you have something you can hook into and bring it up at any point. If you could do that for everybody, I would be incredibly grateful. Personally, on a personal level, I need to wake up tomorrow and be at least 5 stone slimmer than I am. You have to find me a hunky boyfriend.
Right.
And I definitely need an all expenses paid, all inclusive holiday to Jamaica. That's my 3 personal.
Oh.
So you can conjure me.
Can I come with you?
Yes, please.
I probably can't help with the weight. I can't help with the weight. I mean, I could probably try and find you a hunky man, but but I'll definitely come to Jamaica with you.
Yeah, well, I'm saying you got to bring Gary because we've got previous now, so we've got to be careful.
I know. Okay. Val, can I just say, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on hashtag Team Early Childhood Podcast. Here is to many, many more. But thank you for being such an inspiration for us all and for our next generation too.
Aaron, thank you for having me. Thank you for asking me to be a part of this, because without you, you know, I would still be sitting behind a desk somewhere. I haven't really given you a choice,
have I?
No, so, not really. But I'm grateful. I am grateful. Oh,
great. You. Well, thank you so much, Val. And speak to you soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.